Shinosky. I'm a grateful, recovered alcoholic. Amen. I'm sober today by the grace of God and the teaching and miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't had a drink since April 8th, 2001. And to me, that's a miracle. I have to be careful. My sponsors here tonight, there. I don't want to say anything that might give me verbal abuse in the car on the way home. I don't know if anybody was at that roundup yesterday, but I'm still riding high off that. It was the nighttime speaker was just affected me in so many ways because his entire share was about me, and never mind him. You know, he talked about me, he talked about insanity, about the committee, about how his mind worked like a broken Maytag washer, where he didn't have a normal cycle. He just ran on agitate and spin. And that's what I did for quite a few years. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be here. AA saved my life. It's given me a new lease on life. It's given me the ability to live life. And I never had that before. It gave me the ability to live in today to the best of my ability. And I always either lived in the past or in the future, you know. It's like that old saying, you know, I had one foot in the past and one foot on the future, you know. I was just pissing out today. And I didn't know that there was anything wrong with that. When I finally came to these meetings and I started to study the big book, I read a part in the doctor's opinion that said that I had a disease. I had a disease that was an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body, and I was relieved. So I thought I was nuts. I thought I was crazy. I thought I needed to be checked into an insane asylum. I couldn't understand why I did the things I did. You know, and I'm glad to know that that these rooms exist and that I have a disease. I was also really happy to find out when I read the second chapter that there was a solution. And when I got here very early, I didn't care. I really didn't care if there was a solution or not. You know, when I first started coming to meetings, somebody told me pick up a big book and started reading it. So I did. I read the first 164 pages in about a day and a half. And I really thought that I had a photographic memory at the time, so everything just kind of went in my head, and I knew it all. And my first sponsor would sit there, and I'd be quoting him things out of the big book, and he'd be way out of context. And he'd be looking at me like I had four heads, going, "Who is this guy?" And I always thought that I was a really bright guy, and you know, and I could look at it really, really fast. But I came to learn that my head will not keep me sober. You know, I came to learn that my worst enemy lives between my ears, and that it's really my heart and my soul that keep me sober today. So I try to give it to AA as much as I can. I'm just going to qualify a bit very quickly. I had my first drink at the age of 8. I stole a bottle of wine out of my parents' fridge, and I guzzled it down. And I don't remember exactly how I felt, but I know that I really liked it. I enjoyed my first drink, and I think I really enjoyed my last. I just didn't enjoy what it did to me. And I drank the same way. I drank the same way all the time. I've been here for a half an hour, and this is my third cup of coffee because I still can't sip. I'm a gulper. You know, and I gulped every drink that I ever took. You know, the faster it went in, the better off I was, because I wanted to get there as quickly as possible. You know, I had a friend of mine that was, you know, would go buy beer one at a time. What's the point? You know, to me, that's what it was. You know, what's the point? You know, I know that I'm going to sit down and I'm going to have my first beer. I know that I'm going to want more. And, you know, let's just buy a case. I like to walk. Like, something wrong with you. And I didn't know there was something wrong with me. You know, the big book talks about the social drinker. You know, people are able to just go out there and, you know, and don't like the effect produced by alcohol. And that's definitely not true for me, because that's what I drank for. I drank for the effect. I did everything for the effect. You know, I did everything to out. You know, I just needed to get out of mind, get out of body, get out of whatever, get out of town. It didn't matter. You know, I was never happy where I was at that moment. You know, I always thought, I had this the spinning action going on in my head all the time, and I always thought that, you know, my solutions really lie anywhere but where I was. And you people taught me that my solutions are right here, right where my feet are standing right now. And that to me still amazes me. I was kind of a loner because I firmly believed that I didn't know who I was. So how could I fit in anywhere when, you know, you don't know? And my adolescent life seemed to be just a quest of going out there and trying to fit in different spots and in different places with different people. And, you know, I tried drugs very early, and, you know, and if it was, you know, if I would do that just to get me in there and get me involved, then that's what I would do. And when I hit Sijup after high school, I thought I needed to join something. I figured I needed to be a part of. It was already inside of me that I never felt like I'd been a part of anything. You know, I'd been a Boy Scout, a Wolf Cub, the whole thing. It just never seemed to phase. So, when I was in college, I figured, I'll try and join something, you know, and I didn't have any sports that I liked at the college that I went to, so I decided that I was going to be a journalist. So I was going to go join the newspaper, maybe a photojournalist. You know, so I was pretty good with a camera. And I ended up writing for this newspaper, and I felt really comfortable there for a while. And today I look back on it, and I realize that the comfort came out of what the routine was at that newspaper. We had this filing cabinet, and for the first couple of weeks that I was there, I didn't know why the bottom two drawers were locked. And I came to discover on the first night that I was there to produce the newspaper that those drawers became unlocked at 6 o'clock on Tuesday night because there was three guys waiting at the side door and another guy distracting the guard while they brought in beer and ice. And as I opened those doors, I saw them, and they were lined with plastic. So they would just dump in the beer, you know, and ice up the beer, and about an hour later we were ready to go, you know. And I loved that. That was great to me. You know, I was young. I was 15 years old. And I loved it. And we never got caught. Well, I didn't. A couple of guys did. And I never really, it was a lesson that I had in life. I never really needed to be accountable. I never got caught for anything. I always seemed to manage to slide my way out of some situation, one way or another. And after a while, though, I didn't, you know, I wasn't fitting in again. You know, and I come to understand today that it's because my disease was progressing. You know, and those people were normal. You know, they were actually had a goal in life. I didn't have a goal in life. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what career I wanted to pursue. I thought I wanted to do this, and then I switched and I wanted to do that. And I had no clue. I didn't have a clue today, half the time. But today I can accept that. And I remember as we were, you know, as the social life was starting to begin and we were going out to bars and I was getting into the bars. They were 16, 17 years old, and it was great because it was always the same crowd of friends. But I come to understand today that I used them. I didn't like most of them, but as long as I was hanging out in that crowd, you know, if I was in the middle of that, I was pretty much protected getting into that bar at a young age. And they could surround me, you know, and then I could drink, and that's what I wanted to do. And I love bars. I love bars right from the beginning, you know. There was something about the smell of beer and bullshit that, you know, I found completely, completely, you know, gratifying at the time. And, you know, and it was a place where I didn't have to be anybody. You know, everybody just went there and all had a good time. It was a college crowd. Everybody went out there to get tanked. And that was good enough for me. And then after a while, you know, people grow up, and they grew up, and I didn't. You know, and I thought, and as my degree, the disease progressed, they started to get responsible. So suddenly they're going off to college, you know, and I'm still stuck in this rut, and I got kicked out of school, and I started to work. And, you know, and things, you know, and everybody just started to drift off. So I cast myself adrift, and I started going to different areas and different bars, and trying to find the people that I could hook in with, you know, and And as the time went on, you know, the bars got a little dingier. You know, year after year, it just seemed like the light levels got a little lower. You know, and there was the bars became less busy because I didn't like to drink when there was a lot of people. You know, they got really loud, and I didn't like that. And and I created a whole new set of friends, and I started hanging out with another bunch, a couple of guys that I knew, and that's all we did. You know, we just went out and went to the dingiest places that we possibly could, and tried to act like big. Big gangster types, and I have delusions of grandeur. I still have delusions of grandeur. You know, there were like four big guys, you know, who walk into bars. There was like five, six people, you know, on a Sunday night. People would be afraid of us because we'd walk in, you know, we'd have overcoats on, and you know, just be walking in and kind of cruising in the door, and you know, like we owned the goddamn place. We'd never been there. So we just continued doing that for a while, you know, and after that, it just, even that wasn't working. I used to love to, my favorite time to drink, by the way, was winter. On the extremely cold or extremely snowy days. Because I knew that if I went out that night, there'd be nobody else out. And then I, you know, I had these a couple of bars that I go to where I knew the barmaids, and it was really dark, and it was a little bit quiet, and there was... go there at the beginning of the week, and there was never anybody there, and I could just sit down at the bar, you know, and have a few drinks and chew her ear off. And then I got to the point where I'd had so many drinks that I could barely drool, you know. And then I get in my car and go home, and I'm a chronic drunk driver, and I truly believe that being a drunk driver, and I drove under the influence thousands of times, not hundreds, thousands, because I had this extreme self-centered motive of getting where I needed to go, no matter what the results. You know, damn the torpedoes. And that's what I ended up doing. And I went, I got pulled over I don't know how many times. You know, they look at me and go ahead. I thought, this is great. I even fooled the cops. You know? So there's that lack of, that sense of impunity. You know, I thought I could get away with anything. I really enjoyed manipulating the people in my lives. It became a bit of a sport. And through this time, I'd gotten in and out of relationships. And none of them were very healthy, because I wasn't. I listened to a tape a couple of weeks ago. It's Marianne Williamson. Yeah, talking about intimacy. And she was saying, you know, sick attracts sick. And health attracts healthy. You know? I was definitely sick. I was also the type of guy that, I don't know if anybody remembers those, the Lethal Weapon movies. You had Joe Pesci's character, you know, Leo Getz. Anything you want, Leo Getz, you know? And that was me. I could, people would ask me, can you do this? And I'd say, sure. And I didn't have a damn clue. But I could do it. You know, I had this inability to form the word no. You know, I just couldn't spit it out, no matter what. And it got me into more trouble than I could ever imagine. You know, because suddenly as time went on, you know, as my circle started to diminish, you know, the people that spread out from that, they knew that I couldn't be trusted. And I'd worked as an electrician from the time that I was 16, and I went back to school and I became a computer programmer. And, and that was everything. You know, can you do this job? Sure, I'd never show up. You know, because I couldn't do it. It was too much for me. You know, can you write this software for me? Yeah, sure, no problem. And I'd take money, and I'd never do the job. Or I'd start it and just, forget it. You know. And I stole from a lot of people that way. And not only did I steal their money, but I stole their trust. And it's funny, today, my word is what I live by, because I don't have a lot of anything else. You know, I try to do what I can and make sure that I make commitments and that I stick to them. I become responsible and accountable for my actions. You know, and if I could do that at least, then everything else in my day just kind of seems to go well. You know, I take responsibility for my life, my actions, the way I speak to people, the way I treat people. I heard Clancy say on a tape once, you know, the way that I can gauge my day is the way that I treat people that can't talk back to me. The lady at the counter of the donut shop, the waitress, you know, the people that are in public service that should be treated well and treated properly and treated kindly, because like anybody else, they have a bad day and they make a mistake. I need to treat them properly. And that's my gauge. It's how I treat others. And some days I don't do well. You know? But back then I didn't treat anybody well. One of my character defects was rejection of others. You know? I rejected other people, you know. If you didn't fit into a specific box that was about this big that I could, you know, that I could define, then you weren't worthy of knowing me. You know, and as time went on, that box just got smaller and smaller, and I come to understand it's because I didn't think I was worthy of knowing anybody else. And, I was pretty antisocial. My friends used to try and take me to parties. Every time I go to a party, though, I realized that I had to bullshit my way through a party. You know, I really had to manipulate my way. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was about. So what I would do is I would walk into these parties and I would knit myself a personality. And I could put it on. And then I could make my way around the room by discarding and reknitting, you know, new personalities all the time. And then at the end of the night, I just still end up alone because I didn't fit in. When I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was the first place that I really ever felt like I fit in. It was the first place that I ever felt like I belonged from the day I walked in the door. Even though I thought I knew better than everybody else. You know? And that was a great gift to me. You know, because you love me no matter what. I couldn't love myself. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror when I got here. You know, but you people love me, and you taught me how to love unconditionally. And from that, I've been able to have healthy relationships. I was able to meet somebody and get married and have a healthy marriage. And, you know, be able to deal with whatever I need to do, you know, and be able to deal with sponsees. And, you know, I just... every once in a while, I get this overwhelming feeling of deep, deep, deep gratitude. And I'm living in that today. You know, because of you people. You've all shown me so much. And I can never give enough back. As I said, I retrained myself to be a computer programmer. And I started working in that field. And it's funny, as time went on, you know, I would change jobs because I still had that, can you do this? And my immediate answer was, yep. And I kind of lied my way and manipulated my way into a couple of jobs. I worked for a large corporation, I worked for a small corporation, then I worked for a medium corporation. And it just seemed that I always seemed to get out of there just as they would catch up to know that I didn't know as much as I told them that I did. And I just kept moving forward. And the last job that I had led to my last drinking binge. And I was an information technology customer service rep. And basically what I used to do is I used to deal with IT departments of other customers. We did a lot of work online. Together for order placement and deliveries. We had problems with a customer in Ireland, and I was responsible for developing the system that created this whole web application. Anyways, aside the point. And they sent me to Ireland for 10 days. And they're such a wonderful company. You know, they gave me my expense check 2 days before I left. I should have asked them for it, like, give it to me Friday, because I got paid that week, I got my expenses, I was gone. I was out drinking, carousing, having a good time, being completely insane, and I made my plane, how, I don't know, and I ended up on that plane, and I was scared. I was scared like I had never been scared before. Because there was that fear of, can I do it? You know, yeah, you know, say, you know, put your money where the mouth is, time. you know. And I just, I was paralyzed. I drank my way across the ocean. And when I got into Ireland, I checked in with our local office on the Monday, and I spent about 10 minutes there, and then I got driven to the to my hotel. And, you know, the first thing on my mind was, God, I need a drink. I need a nap, but I need a drink. So I've been up for about 3 days. And I just remember I got to the hotel, I checked in, and I said, wake me up at 6 o'clock and bring me two Smithwicks and a steak. And there was a knock on my door at 6 o'clock, and there was two Smithwicks and a steak. And I had those two beers, I ate, and I was instantly felt better. Instantly. And, you know, lack of sleep or not, boy, I just had to wander right down the hallway into the pub, you know. It was very narrow hallways in that hotel, a good thing, because it was only one crossover step between wall to wall every night that I went back. And the only thing that I ever did in Ireland was work and drink. And I didn't do anything. I didn't do any sightseeing. I was in the office the entire 12 days that I was there. If I wasn't in the office, I was either in a restaurant drinking or I was in a pub drinking. And, you know, I remember I was so afraid. Finally, I'd been through a set of meetings. When I finally got to the day where I was able to complete my task, the next night was Thursday night, and it was time to celebrate. And I took a hostage. You know, this poor guy that was the guy that I was working with. He was about 5'6" and 120 pounds. He was trying to keep up with a celebrating 300-pound Polak. It was just he was not pretty. By the time he went home, and you know, and I didn't care. You know, I didn't need to work the next day. You know, I went into the office anyways at 10:30. My mission was accomplished, and he was just a complete no-show. You know, and I realized today that I owe him an amends. You know, because I wouldn't let him go home. He was trying to go home at midnight, 1 o'clock. You know, to be able to get some sleep so that he could get into the work next day. And I almost had him by the collar, dragging him down the street, throwing him into a cab, and saying, "Where can we drink now?" And I came back from Ireland a corporate hero for about a day, and then was back to business. But I knew my time was up. Something wasn't right. And I made a decision that I needed to stop. I needed to stop everything. I needed to stop lying to myself. I needed to stop hurting other people. I needed to stop hurting myself. I went to my first meeting the week after that, because I went on a week-long bender, and you know, I drank and used every night, and I went to my first meeting the next Monday, and I remember it was upstairs, and those stairs seemed about that high. I think there was 10, and I just remember standing at the bottom of those stairs just going, do I really need to go in? I'm feeling much better now. You know, and I went in anyways, and you know, and I was so thankful there was somebody at the door to greet me. Somebody at the door to shake my hand. And I walked in the door, and he said, "Hi, my name's Harold, and welcome, and you're in the right place. And I'd like to know how the hell that son of a bitch knew I was in the right place." I know it today, because I had that look. I had that complete look of paralytical fear on my face, where I didn't know where I was going, and I didn't know anything about the program, nothing. You know, I heard it mentioned vaguely on, you know, on TV shows, and you know, and maybe crossed over it in the paper every once in a while, but I didn't have a clue what I was in for. You know, and all I knew was that I just wanted to stop doing what I was doing for a little while so that I could get my life back on track and just go back to it. And as it was the case, I learned that that's not what this is about. And I had this wonderful case of recuperative alcoholism, and my ego recuperated very, very quickly. after I started going to meetings for a couple of weeks because I got a sponsor, I started to talk about stuff and get things out, you know, and I was reading the big book, and, you know, and then after about 3 weeks, I thought I knew, I felt okay, and I thought I knew what was wrong with everybody else. You know, and I, you know, and I judged you, and I laughed at you, you know, and I hated you. But I needed you. And I knew in my heart that I needed you, because in that short time that I had been to meetings, people were just, like, nobody would let me go home after a meeting, you know. I felt like I was in grade one, you know, a teacher grabbing you by the ear and dragging me out. You know, I put on about 45 pounds because they were taking me and throwing me into the car and, you know, driving for Chinese food at 11 o'clock at night in Chinatown. You know, and let's go for coffee, and let's go for this, and, you know, after meetings, every night, I was never alone. And then I committed what I like to call the cardinal sin of newcomers. I met somebody, you know, and I met a woman. She's not my wife. And I just remember that my perception, you know, to me she said all the right things. You know, to me she did all the right things. To me the body language meant love forever. And, you know, I had a friend of mine sitting there on a Friday night after a meeting just going, you know, quoting the 12 and 12 to me. You know, he goes, it's on page 119 of the 12 and 12. Boy meets girl on AA campus. I suggest you read that paragraph. And, well, I read it later, because I wasn't interested in reading it then. And they told me at the same time, they said, you know, if you can't stay out for yourself, she's new too. Can you stay out for her? And it was, screw you. You don't know us. You don't know me. You don't know where I've been. And I went out to prove everybody right. And I did. And I ended up having a slip, a one-night affair, and that was my last drink. By the grace of God, hopefully my last one. And I called my sponsor that night as I was driving home, you know, all guilty and ashamed and embarrassed. And, you know, and I just remember, you know, almost crying on the phone going, I slipped. All I could hear on the other end of the line was, good, let's get to work. And that's what we did. That's what we did. We started working the steps. The true miracle. You know? And I had to learn that my life was unmanageable. You know, I knew that night, I knew that I was powerless, because as much as I was sitting there reaching for that beer, my head going, do it, do it, do it, and my heart going, don't. And I've come to understand that my disease lives in my head, not in my heart. And that night, I was powerless. And I couldn't stop. I just couldn't. And I have people tell me, yeah, sure you could have. No, I couldn't have. Because I'd made the decision, no matter how right or wrong, that I was going to pick up that drink. And if I ever try and tell anybody different, I'm lying and I'm kidding myself at the same time. And it was in an instant. And I'd been on a 90 and 90. And it was the first night in that 90 and 90 that I did not go to a meeting. And that's why I try and tell newcomers, do a meeting a day for a little while at least. Just to get on track. And I had numbers. I had numbers I could have called. And I wasn't interested. I wasn't interested because I was more interested in those, you know, curly eyelashes and that drink than I was in staying sober. I came to understand that that's really slip, sobriety losing its priority, that that's truly what it means. Suddenly sobriety took an immediate bottom shelf to everything else in my life at that moment. And I struggled. You know, I took a beginner's chip the next night, and I couldn't lift my chin off my chest. I couldn't say one word to anybody. You know, and everybody was just going, keep coming back, way to go, keep coming back. And in my mind, I'm going, oh, don't bother me, get the hell away from me. because that was my immediate reaction. Anytime anything went bad, just buzz off. I have to deal with this stuff on my own. I've come to understand today that I don't. I have a sponsor. You know, I have a sponsor that when I need to deal with stuff, I can pick up the phone and call him. If I need to see him, we make an appointment and I go talk to him. Because I need to be able to have that vessel to drop all my negative stuff in. You know, and be able to talk about it and deal with it and take those negatives and turn them into a positive. You know, and take those mistakes and turn them into lessons so that I can move forward in my life. And, you know, and I was so grateful that I didn't get that it's okay. You know, it's okay, just go take a newcomer chip tomorrow. I'm glad I didn't get that. Because if I would have gotten that, I'd have never shown up the next night. I needed a firm hand and a sponsor, and I got one. We were laughing last night because I was giving a sponsee a hard time, and he said, you know, he goes, you make a pretty good SOB sponsor. And I said, hey, I learned from the best. Yeah, and that's what I needed. That's what I needed. I needed somebody to be hard with me. I needed somebody to be to the point with me. I needed somebody not to lie to me and to push me. Because left to my own devices, I am lazy. And if it's just bad tomorrow, great procrastinator. You know, I love having stuff to do tomorrow. And unfortunately, that piles up after a while. I started to work the steps, and I started to come to understand a few things about the steps of this program. And for myself, this is all I understood. You know, I understood that my life was unmanageable because I made it as such. And the things that make my life unmanageable are my character defects. And I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself was going to restore me to sanity. I had to believe in something. I had to have some faith. I never believed in anything before. You know, I went to church when I was a kid, and you know, and I had this true belief in a loving God, not a punishing God. And I just pushed him aside. I didn't believe that I deserved anything that a loving God could give me. You know, I'd rather have a God that would beat me over the head with a stick. That's what I thought I deserved. And I had to learn that, you know, my higher power lives in all of you. You know, and I had to come to terms with that and realize that as long as I listened to what you people had to say, that I would get better. And when I made the decision to start doing what you told me to do, that's when my life really changed. And my sponsor told me that I had to do an inventory, and he said, "Well, we have 17-week workshops, step workshops starting." And I got involved with that, and I sat down and I did my inventory, and I shared it with him. And he didn't throw me out of his house, which I greatly appreciated. But he also did something for me. The importance of doing my fifth with a sponsor was the fact that he knew I was holding back something. And he pulled two things out of me that would have completely invalidated my fifth. Because I needed to be as honest and as open as I could be. I learned that my defects of character are my defense mechanisms, and that back when I was drinking, I just lived in them in the extreme. And now, as long as I'm willing not to have them anymore, my higher power decides which ones I get to keep for that day as long as I ask them. I had to clear the rest of the wreckage of the past. I'm still working on that. I don't know if it's just me or my perception of the steps, but I truly believe that the amends process is ongoing and it never ends until I end. Because there's people out there that I'm going to hurt that I don't know about, perhaps wittingly, perhaps unwittingly, people that I will never get the chance to make direct amends to, that as long as I'm here and I'm a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm out there helping people as much as I can, that's the amends that I need to make to them and to society. You know, I had such a gift, I was able to take my parents off my list. You know, because they told me I could. And I get to live, I live my life in the miracle of steps 10, 11, and 12. I get to look at myself on a daily basis, and I have learned to love myself. So that's not a painful process anymore. And I get to do those spot checks. And the beauty of working this program to me has been the ability to be slightly self-aware and kind of know that I'm doing something stupid well in advance of doing it, so that I can, you know, stop. You know, I have to check my dishonesty. You know, I have to check if I'm being selfish, if I'm being afraid, if I'm being resentful. I have to see, you know, am I living in the stream of life? Is there anything that I need to talk to anybody about right away? Are there any amends that I need to make immediately? I need to have a conscious contact. I need to pray. You know, I need to talk to God. When I meditate, I listen, and I my day is kind of frazzled, so I don't have the intestinal fortitude to get up 15 minutes early to meditate. But what I try to do is during my days, whenever I get a chance, I'm very fortunate. I have a job that I drive, and I'm an electrician on service, so I get to go from building to building. And when I get the opportunity to stop, if I'm not feeling quite right before I walk out of the truck, I get to stop and turn it off and take a minute for myself and try and create that contact, you know, and get calm again, and have some serenity. And you know, and I love doing service. I love helping out in AA. You don't have to ask me twice. You know? And the only times that I ever say no now is when I truly have a prior commitment. If I can't get there, I can't get there, but I never say no. And it's been the gifts that I've gotten because of this are too numerous that I can mention. You know, I have friends today. I didn't have friends. I had drinking buddies for years. You know, I have people that I can talk to. I said it before. I met a woman in AA. She's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and we got married about a year and a half ago. You know, that's been a great gift because I thought that I was, you know, a complete piece of garbage and that no woman would ever want to know me. You know, because I had treated them as such in the past. And I managed to put that behind me and be able to get to have somebody good. God put her in my path. You know, and I know that to the bottom of my heart. And, you know, and I have a sponsor and I have sponsees and we have such a large sponsorship family, you know. I just never feel like I can fall off the edge, you know. And I was taught that very early. As long as you stay in the middle of AA, you got people around you that'll protect you when you start moving out. But, you know, if you ride around the rim, boy, there's nothing out there to stop you from falling off. And I like it in the middle. I've gained a new love for Alcoholics Anonymous in the past little while. I had come to a point where I was finding it difficult to go to meetings because I wanted to go. You know, I was going to meetings because I needed to go. And I guess that's okay at the bare minimum, but it's not that I had any problem with Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just I had a problem with me. And I was going through a tough time. And that immediate need to isolate and to get the hell out started to creep in. And I'm fortunate that I was able to at least make it to my home group, which is Serendipity on Thursday nights. We do have a beginner's meeting. You know, I'd be able to hang on and get some fellowship and hear what I need to hear that might be able to carry me over until I could get off my arse and go to another meeting to get what I need. Because I get everything I need here. I don't need anything else. Everything I need is right in that book that taught me how to live life. And I can never repay the debt to Alcoholics Anonymous for my life. But I'll go out there and try as often as I can. If you're new and struggling in this program, please don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, go as many meetings as possible, get active in a home group. Service saves, there's no doubt about it. There's nothing better for me when I'm in my head to go help another alcoholic to get out of it. And, you know, if you can just do that, you know, don't drink, go to meetings. You'll be all right. You know, you'll be all right. There's people here that'll help you. All you got to do is be willing to get some help. And Thanks very much, Grant, for asking me. You're over there. And I want to wish each and every one of you a very good 24th.